Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's Monday morning, March 18th, 2019. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Machicki, Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilikowski. We've also been joined by Senate President Geisel, Majority Leader Costello, and Senator Stevens and Birch. So we've got a good group here today from the Senate to listen to the order of business, which is the spring forecast update for our revenue. And then we're going to follow that up with an oil and gas production tax audit update, which I think the committee will find very interesting, and the subcommittee is working diligently on that issue also. But I thought it'd be nice to kind of bring everybody up to speed a little bit as we work through that process, because there are substantial funds under review. And with that, I'd like to go ahead and call Commissioner Tangeman to the table, please. He's going to present the spring revenue forecast to us. And then we will, I'd like to note and thank the support staff of the, before we get going, the Finance Committee and the building maintenance staff. We have on Friday and Saturday, they cut a hole in the end of the table where the presenter is and lowered the screen, the computer screen, and let it into the table, so which will give our presenters more room, make it easier for them to sit more towards the center, and for all the committee members to have a good direct interaction with the presenter. And the first specimen to the table for that is the Commissioner of Revenue. With that, Mr. Tangeman, if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then give us some good news if you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Commissioner, Department of Revenue. I don't like not being able to hide back here anymore, a little more exposed. So I'll be walking through the spring revenue forecast update. As you all know, this is an update to the fall forecast. Fall forecast is a more robust 100-plus page document. This is a 20-page update to that document. I wish I had some good bailout news for you this morning, but we didn't see a lot of changes on the revenue side. It's pretty flat, pretty predictable. But there were a few changes that we'll be walking through. Some of the highlights before we get into the slide deck. The FY19 price that we showed you in the fall, we were estimating $67.96. That's only gone up about a dollar. FY20 oil price, we are showing $64. That has gone up to $66. And the out years are the same. So it's still pretty stable and flat. Production is down a little bit for FY19. We're also predicting production to be down slightly for FY20, but for the most part, fairly stable. So again, we'll be walking through the changes from the fall forecast. We will touch on ANS oil price. We will touch slightly on oil production forecast. That's DNR's realm. We will speak to it briefly, only because there's not much of a story to tell there. If you'd like to get into more details, probably having DNR come up and speak to that at a future date, but it's fairly uneventful from the delta between the fall and the spring forecasts. I will talk a little bit about the North Slope lease expenditures update, and then the oil credit forecast, and also the bonding update. There's been some changes since the fall forecast to that as well. On slide four, we see the delta between the fall and spring forecast for unrestricted general fund, petroleum revenue, non-petroleum revenue, total revenue, and then at the bottom we show the permanent fund transfer from SB 26 legislation. So in the first column, if you jump down to the unrestricted general fund total revenue, we show a decrease of about $89 million for FY19. For FY20, we show an increase of about $40 million. On the next slide, we'll talk about some of the details that went into those numbers. But as you can tell, there's not a whole lot of change in the price forecast or in the revenue forecast for the next 10 years or so. Permanent fund transfer has literally changed de minimis, really. There's not much of a change at all in the transfers, fairly stable.
And before you jump to the next slide, maybe on of some interest to see out to 2028, but I think we're more interested in the FY19 through the next 2-3 years as we work forward. But under the 19 and 20 numbers, the negative $90 million change in the unrestricted and the positive $39 million for FY20, can you give us a rough feel for how that is split up amongst the components that drove that? Is it dealing with our fish tax collections or our oil tax collections, or what drives that?
Mr. Chairman, if we go to slide 5, I do have a little bit of breakdown on there. On that slide, I've got some experts sitting behind me that can go a little deeper if you'd like. But so for 19, production tax was reduced by about $80 million. We saw a higher oil price by about a dollar that we're forecasting, and that was offset by the decrease to production. Lower than expected FERC payments on the pipeline, higher than expected refunds and other company specific items reduced the production tax by $105 million. The increase was $25 million for oil price, so that equated to a reduced petroleum tax of about $80 million. Non-petroleum corporate income tax was reduced slightly, and that's might be a timing issue, but it's definitely lower than expected in December. Other revenues of about $2 million reduced, and then royalties increased by about $8 million, mostly due to the higher oil prices. So that netted out to the reduction of $89 million. And then for 20, similar categories, the production tax increased by about $45 million, again, due to higher oil prices of about $2 forecast. And the production is slightly reduced, very slightly. And we'll show you that later slide. I think it's only down a couple thousand barrels a day. And again, royalties increased by $19 million due to the higher oil prices. Non-petroleum CIT is corporate income tax. Again, that was reduced slightly, mostly due to the minerals aspect, which we usually don't see or talk about very much in the forecast. So if we have questions about that, we can bring up some folks from the department to speak to. And then other revenues were reduced by $10 million due to a variety of smaller non-petroleum forecast changes.
On the previous year, or the current year, actually 19, but the previous portion, you mentioned the FERC payments. We don't really have payments to FERC. So how do you, can you further define that as you're talking about the tariffs, or what kind of payments do we have going to FERC?
I'd like to have Dan Stickle come up and speak to those details for us.
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickle, I'm an economist with Department of Revenue. So in regards to the FERC-related payments, there was a settlement of some prior year tariff calculations dealing with how the tariffs for the Trans-Alaska pipeline are calculated. And those were that was a dispute that was going on and involved Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, also known as FERC, which is the regulating body of the pipeline. And so there was multiple years of calculations where a agreement of a methodology for making those TAPS tariff calculations was settled, and we had done some modeling in Department of Revenue and come up with an estimate of the receipts that would be received because it's a net benefit to the state. Slightly lower TAPS tariffs for historical years result in slightly higher production tax liabilities. We were estimating $160 million would be received in fiscal year 19 related to those prior year liabilities, and the actual receipts came in about half what we were expecting.
And Mr. Stickle, so that payment doesn't go to FERC? What, who gets the money? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, that money is general fund money that comes to the state.
So when that, when you overestimate it, explain to me a little bit more how that works, because FERC doesn't get a check. So.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, so this has to do with the tariffs that were deducted in calculating prior year taxes. So for, you know, we'll just take, for example, in 2014 was one of the years involved in the settlement. The producers used a certain TAPS tariff to arrive at their gross value and their net value and paid a tax based on the tariff that was used at the time. The settlement results in a slightly lower TAPS tariff for that calendar year, so those producers are going to refile their, or have refiled their taxes using the lower TAPS tariff, which results in a higher gross value and a higher net value and a little bit of additional tax liability to the state. And so along with that refiling, they'll have an additional tax liability and make an additional payment, or in some cases use credits to offset that.
So what you're explaining to the public is the Trans-Alaska Pipeline cost of running it. And as that cost goes up and down, it affects our net value because we're under a net tax.
That's correct, Mr.
Chairman. And then that moves our tax receipts either up or down depending on the settlement.
That's correct.
So you forecasted an expectation and a forecast, and we all understand the forecast, and it didn't turn out as robust to the Treasury as anticipated, so you had to make an adjustment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
We have a question from Senator Von Imhoff and Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Trust Edmund. So right next to the course of the FERC payments, you have higher than expected refunds. Are you going to be explaining this later on in the presentation? What does that mean?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, what this has to do with the migrating credits issue around the Senate Bill 21 tax regime. So companies actually give us an estimated payment on a monthly basis based on the amount of per taxable barrel credits that can be applied against production tax in that particular month. Then at the end of the year, once there's a true up for the entire year, if there was been price volatility during the year and they're able to take any per taxable barrel credits that were not able to be fully used in a given month of low prices where the minimum tax was what they paid, and potentially apply some excess credits back to higher price months. And so what we saw in the forecast this year is we had some higher price months in the middle of 2018 in the July-August timeframe, and then prices fell quite a bit at the end of the year, and the December price in particular was a lot lower than it was in, earlier in the year. So companies were able to take some of the credits earned in December and apply those back to earlier months in the year. So we're now forecasting about, I believe it's about $50 million in refunds, and we're expecting those to be claimed and go out the door in the next month or two.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, you referred to the tax settlements. Does any of those funds go to the Constitutional Budget Reserve account? And if not, why not?
Senator Hoffman, last year we received an opinion that settlement of a tax dispute, if the dispute is surrounding the tax itself, does go to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. However, since the TAPS issue, it's not a dispute about the tax itself. It's a the dispute was about the TAPS tariff and happened outside of the tax calculation. And so that was deemed not to be subject to the CBRF deposit. And so we're treating that as general fund for purposes of the forecast.
Follow up,
and who gave you that opinion?
Senator Hoffman, that through the chair, that came from the previous Attorney General, to my knowledge.
think for those watching at home, what we're looking at here is a fairly substantial issue, although it might sound like a fairly minor one. And I think we have, from our side of the table, differences of opinion and an interest in looking into that further and maybe reviewing that decision to see that those monies are put in the constitutional budget reserve instead of the general fund. And for those watching at home, technically they're both general funds. They're the constitutional budget reserve is a component part of it, but it takes 3/4 vote to get the money out of the constitutional budget reserve, where a simple majority for the earnings or the general fund. And some of the concern we have at the table is the potential of the settlements coming directly into the general fund and then artificially lowering a budgetary deficit we have, or increasing a budgetary surplus if we happen to have a surplus in any given year. And then we make decisions that are more immediate and may not be in the best long-term interest of cash flow of the state. So to Senator Hoffman's point, the committee is looking into that, and we're going to be having some discussions among ourselves and decide when we want to bring that discussion into the middle of the table. But that issue is a big one. There's also another component part of this is payments into the permanent fund, and the percentage split on that is another issue. So they're big financial issues that we'll be working on, Senator Hoffman.
But the legislature can, if it wanted to, take those general funds and put them into the constitutional budget reserve account, because the legislature does owe the constitutional budget account millions of dollars.
I think that's accurate. We're the appropriators, and we can move the money in the event that we don't come up with an agreed position between the two branches of the government. Right. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, thank you. I just have two quick ones. One, so essentially what you're saying is on the lower than expected line, it's about a 50-50 split between the FERC settlement adjustment and the per barrel annual true-up. Is that correct?
Senator Machicki, through the chair. Let's see, it's 105. So each of these three items, I think the FERC payment was the FERC related was the bigger piece. The higher than expected refunds was about $20 million. The company specific was about $30 million. So the FERC shortfall would be around $50 million, if off the top of my head.
And just follow up. And that's just a miscalculation on the FERC payments, right? It's not a revenue change. It was just a miscalculation from the fall forecast.
Yeah, Senator Machicki, through the chair, that's correct. So we knew that this settlement had taken place, and we knew that the companies would be refiling tax returns. So then what we did in Department of Revenue is we went through each company's specific calculation and attempted to estimate what the true-up liability would be with interest. And our estimate was a little bit on the high side.
And Mr. Chair, through the chairman, just to clarify, I wouldn't categorize it as a miscalculation. I think it'd be just a change in the forecast amount. Again, these were all forecasted amounts, so it wasn't a miscalculation, as in the wrong number was put in because of a calculation error. It was more of a forecasting issue.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What is the effective oil and gas production tax rate in FY 2020?
Senator Wilkowski, we have, through the chair, I don't have that calculation off the top of my head based on the new forecast, but we'll get that for you.
Thank you.
I think to Senator Wilkowski's question, Friday's presentation, which originally was going to be part of today, but today got too lengthy and there was we had more questions or more requests to the Department of Revenue, so they'd like to have a few more days. So on Friday, we're going to have a cash flow comparison with 17 and 18, which are actual years, 19, which is we're halfway through or 3/4 of the way through, whatever, and then we're going to look at 20 and 21. And in those component parts, it would be very easy to do the effective tax rate if we're dealing with whatever component part the committee wants to look at. And we'll see with those 5 years, varying degrees of price and production. And so we'll have at least 1 year, if not two, in minimum tax, and then some of the years in the net profit tax. So that we'll have that for the committee on Friday, I'm sure, Senator Wilkowski. Other questions? Just a quick note on the settlement issue. The subcommittee that Senator Wilson is in charge of is working on some of those issues, and he'll be bringing back more information from his subcommittee on some of those settlement issues and potential revenue or not, and it's going to be revenue and sizable amounts of it to the committee, so we'll be kind of up to speed when he's done with his subcommittee process. And the committee at that time then may want to make that just a subject matter of a future meeting, because it's significant revenues, including the discussion that Senator Hoffman brought up of where the revenues go. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the Executive Budget Act, the governor is required to provide a 10-year fiscal plan in December. We still don't have that. Any idea when we might get that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we do have that in final draft form, so it should be hopefully ready to go sometime this week.
I have spoken on that issue with the commissioner and informed him that I'm not too excited about the 10-year plan. I'm more concerned about getting to the medium, long term, and to the short term. In other words, looking out over the next 2 or 3 years. So the long-term numbers long-term forecasting used in that 10-year plan, I think, has minimal value to the table, but we'll be bringing, when they're ready, we'll be bringing that subject matter up and having a presentation on it. And hopefully we can focus more in on the short term. If we can't even predict that, so the long term is pretty volatile, but that has not been set aside or anything, Senator Wilkowski. We're just trying to set the discussion up and the timing up. Senator Chickie.
Yeah, just Mr. Chairman, could you have Department of Revenue explain, so there's a $50 million delta, but do we view the 89 as almost like a supplemental because it's FY19 as opposed to the increase of 39 million in 20? How do they look at that $89 million hit in FY19?
The commissioner could go ahead and give his view, but it just makes a bigger hole, but go ahead.
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Senator Machicki. Not necessarily a supplemental. The FY19 budget passed with the CBR vote. The forecast at the time was for $63 oil.
Just if you could stop there. Explain it so the folks at home could understand the mechanisms we're using and how when we run over 100 million or we run negative 200 million, how that automatically adjusts itself in the final budgetary process and what we call a true up.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Good point. So when the legislature passed the budget last spring for FY19, they were estimating $63 oil and they projected about a $700 million deficit for the year. At the same time, SB 26 was passed, which is the POMB draw. There was a lot of discussion in the building and with the executive branch about, since this was the first time we were accessing the earnings reserve of the permanent fund through a structured process, I think everyone wanted to make sure that revenues drawn down earlier were those that were earning a lower return. The CBR is a fairly liquid account. It earns a fairly low return, under probably a couple percent. The earnings reserve in the permanent fund is geared towards earning a higher return, more of a long-term return. So there was language put in the bills to make sure that the CBR was accessed first
and then a process would be set up with the permanent fund, between the permanent fund and the Department of Revenue, to draw down as required from the earnings reserve. Almost the Department of Revenue making cash calls to the permanent fund to draw down money from the ERA as required. So that sets the stage on the process of accessing both the CBR and the earnings reserve to bring enough revenue to the table to cover the FY19 budget. Fast forward 6 or 8 months, we now see that the price of oil has been well above $63. It's actually, we're forecasting around 69, which is about what the actuals are year to date, a little less. However, we did draw down the full amount of the CBR at the beginning of the fiscal year. We've made several cash calls from the earnings reserve since then. So while the $89 million may look like a hole or a supplemental, if you will, we still have revenue to cover that purely based on the forecast that was put in place and the budget that was passed. So between the CBR amount that was drawn down and the earnings reserve that have been and will be drawn down, we have enough revenue to cover the FY19 budget.
And for those watching at home, the net number is going to be a smaller negative number for FY19, which will increase the constitutional budget reserve balance that we use as our main savings account by $300 or $400 million or so. Any other questions on this page? Senator Wilikowski.
This is on the SB 26 draw that you just mentioned. In the Alaska Permanent Fund balance sheet, January 2018, it showed the total fund balance of $66 billion. In 2019, January, it showed a fund balance of $63 billion, so a drop of $3 billion in the fund balance. And yet the draw is going up from $2.7 to $2.9 billion. Is that a flaw in the system that we're decreasing the balance of the permanent fund and yet increasing the draw?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I wouldn't call it a flaw. Obviously, the balance is going to change quarter to quarter depending on the market. Fortunately, this body and the previous administration put a lot of thought into SB 26 and put in a process to smooth out the draws. Instead of just looking at last year's ending balance and drawing 5.25 from that, you do a 5-year look back. So while we do see quarterly changes in the balance of the fund itself, the POMV draw calculation is based on a smooth 5-year average. So I wouldn't put too much stock in what it does quarter to quarter as far as it affects the POMV draw calculation. That is going to be based on the closing balance of the previous 5 years.
So let's bring it back to the more on the subject matter today, and we can go into the permanent fund and the calculations at another meeting, but clearly there's a lot of moving parts to it. And that, as the commissioner mentioned, the portion that's pulled out for dividends and state services are average of historical values. Go ahead and continue with the next slide, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll now move to the ANS oil price forecast portion. So this, on slide 7, we show the fall 2018 forecast price and the spring 2019 forecast price. Just to refresh everyone's memory, we saw quite a bit of volatility in the fall of 2018. We saw prices go over $80 and then go down to 50s within a matter of a few months. The price forecasting session that was taking place during right in the middle of those big fluctuations led the previous administration to put a price forecast out that turns out was probably a little high. So when we came into office on early December, we chose to look back
see what had happened actually over the last couple months. No harm, no foul, but we needed to put a more realistic price forecast in place in order to start the budget process. So we went back to the spring 2018 forecast, which was fairly stable, and we implemented that for the fall 2018 forecast, which is what you see here as far as 2020 through 2028. 2019 in the spring forecast, you do see an increase of about a dollar. We have seen some pretty decent oil prices, especially this calendar year. It's been fairly stable. So the price forecast for 2019 is up almost a dollar. The biggest change really is the 2020 fall 18 to spring 19 forecast. We show a $2 increase, or about 3%. The reason we're showing that is obviously based on the actual calendar or fiscal year to date. But we're also using, and if I could jump to the next slide, since this one's fairly uneventful. Excuse me, sir, the computer's a little slow right now. We take an ease, please, sir.
I'll have a brief at ease. The record, go ahead and continue.
Thank you, sir. So, since we are recognizing that prices for FY19 are up, not only from the $63 from last spring, but also from the fall forecast, we chose to use NYMEX for the balance of FY19 and also for FY2020, mainly because using a price of almost $69 for 2019, dropping down to $64 for 2020 and then jumping back up to $66 for 2021 didn't seem realistic, because we are showing fairly smooth, stable prices for the next 10 years, and that blip didn't make sense visually. So we looked at available information in NYMEX, which is good at predicting oil prices in the near term, was using that $66 as well. We're in that ballpark. So that's why we use 66 for FY20, and then for 2021 and out, we're sticking with the previous price forecast. In real dollars, it remains in the low to mid-20s. In nominal dollars, it climbs to $77 in 2028.
I just want to pick the pace up a little bit.
Thank you, sir. So we'll move on to slide 9. I'm going to have Ed speak to some of the highlights here on this slide about drivers in the oil price change globally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, Chief Economist, State of Alaska. So as we're looking at the price forecast and how to update the forecast, we elected not to change the long-term forecast because the market fundamentals hadn't changed significantly. We did change the near-term forecast, just as the commissioner was saying, because we needed to see what the market was doing in the near term and pick a number that didn't come from the administration that was supported by the evidence, and that NYMEX number was that number. Looking forward, though, we should always recognize the fact that predicting oil prices is a very difficult thing to do, and this slide just represents some of the things that we're paying attention to that could significantly move the price of oil, both in the near term and in the long term. Right now, in the near term, there are a lot of factors, specifically around geopolitical factors, including trade and regime changes and other potential for conflict around oil-producing countries that could disrupt oil production. We also just heard this weekend that OPEC decided not to change their decision to cut back on oil production, so we don't expect oil prices to drop due to that, as Venezuela is currently also has production offline. So there's a lot of upward price pressure on in the near term, and that pressure will probably continue through at least the rest of the first half of this year, the next 3 months or so. And then there's a lot of things that we're paying attention to that could push that price back down to the more in the $63, $65 range. So, but just all of that to say nothing more than we don't really know what's going to happen in the future, and that there are a lot of things that are going to prove our forecast wrong. That doesn't mean that we don't acknowledge them. It means we don't know if they're going to happen or not. And this slide, Mr. Chairman, kind of demonstrates what the market sees as that volatility and potential for the range of possible outcomes. This is the new EIA forecast, the Energy Information Agency. They put out this forecast every year. This is the one that came out in January. And you can see that range of potential future prices that we're paying, that they are projecting and that we're paying attention to. But Mr. Chairman, our forecast, our current forecast, is still in line with what analysts and what the markets are predicting, so we don't feel like there's anything that should be alarming in the forecast that's being presented. It is consistent and in the middle of the range of what people believe the future may look like. And so for budgeting purposes, we think that the numbers are still supported by the fundamentals. And in the last of these slides, Mr. Chairman, just shows that our current near-term forecast follows the NYMEX curve. That is because we're using the NYMEX curve as the best indicator of near-term prices. And then as you move out forward, you'll notice that NYMEX has a tendency to discount future prices the further you go out, and that turns out not to be the best predictor of long-term prices. So we're still analyzing what the best way to look at long-term prices are going to be, but the current forecast is still in line with analyst expectations.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Trustee Edmund. So if I was just looking at flipping between slide 7 and slide 12 here, because slide 7, you actually start you list out $66 for 2020, $66 for 2021, and $67 for 2022. You just kind of look at the black dotted line here, and it just looks less than halfway between 60 and 70. And I was just curious. I mean, you have analysts have it a little higher. It just looks like that the black line really hasn't been adjusted to be more like in the 66, 67 range. It looks like it's more of 62, 63 range.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair. I direct you to the title of the slide and notice that these are, numbers are adjusted for inflation.
Oh, okay, thanks.
Go ahead and continue.
Slide 13, we'll move on to the oil production forecast. Again, we only have one slide in here.
On the record, go ahead and continue, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We only have one slide in here on production forecast. Like I said earlier, it is down a little bit for 2019. It climbs back to the forecast nearly for 2020 and remains fairly stable compared to the fall forecast for 2018. Any in-depth conversation, we would defer to DNR on this.
Okay, but on this slide, and then we're going to walk into expenditure forecasts here. Can you tell us about Willow and Pica, the two large fields we're working on, and how they're integrated in or not into this analysis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They are integrated into this analysis. However, as you recall, the production forecast is risked. We take all the information that we have. We don't assume that a field will come on in 5 years as predicted or hoped for at full production at the time that they're estimating. The prudent way for the Department of Revenue to account for hoped for and expected
oil production is to put a risking mechanism in there. So the closer to the current timeline a field might come on, the less of a risk because CapEx is invested. They're assuming that it's going to be coming on fairly soon. The further out, in Pikka and Willow or a few years out still, there is a risk associated with those, either A, not hitting the production forecast, or B, not coming on at the estimated timeline. So while this number does hover around 500,000 barrels for 10 years, which compared to history is flat production is a very good sign for the state. There is upside if Willow, if Pikka, if some of these larger fields do come on at expected rates.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems like a pretty big miss on FY19 from 526 down to 511. Normally, you would expect a big miss years out. But what do you attribute that to?
I believe that was the Nakayachuk field that was either was down. Was it down? Yeah, it was offline for a certain amount of time.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
So I'll have Dan Stickle come back up and speak to the lease expenditure forecast.
Sure. Looking at slide 16, again for the record, Dan Stickle with Department of Revenue. So slide 16 shows our North Slope capital expenditures forecast for the spring forecast compared with the previous fall forecast. The big change that we've made from the spring to the fall is to incorporate some new information about the cost of development for some of the new fields that are in our forecast. These are fields like Pikka and Willow and some other smaller new developments as well. So based on new submissions from the operators about their cost plans as well as review of public information and tax returns that we've received since coming up with the fall forecast, it looks like just the cost profile for those new developments is going to be a little bit higher than what we were expecting in the fall. So that's the main change to the lease expenditure forecast here. Again, the significant increase up into the over $3 billion a year timeframe in the 2021 to 2022 timeframe represents when we're expecting to see a lot of spending on those new developments. As the commissioner mentioned, on the production side, we do have a risking methodology for how we incorporate those new developments. We do apply risking on the lease expenditures forecast as well. And so if all of those new fields come in along with expectations, this could actually prove to be a conservative spending forecast as well.
So then on in your source book on page 106, there's this tax value of carry forward annual losses. Then those could be underestimated? Last comment?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And for those watching at home, we're talking about in FY22 of $1.2 billion, $1.5 billion in 23, $1.7 billion, 24, $1.8 billion in 25, I guess. So there's significant dollars here we're talking about.
Yeah, sure. And Mr. Chairman, on page 13 of the spring revenue forecast, we do include a table that lays out the estimated tax value of carried forward losses in the spring forecast. And again, these are based on the risked estimates of future company spending.
And just for those watching at home, I was looking in the previous book. I wasn't using the numbers from the update, so I apologize for that. I grabbed the wrong book here. I got them both. So in 23, there's an increase of almost $440 million. So there's significant deltas going on in upcoming attractions or upcoming developments, and they could be more than that as far as dollar amounts. So at some point, we're going to have a discussion on that and how that is integrated into our cash flow analysis and the impacts of that.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, for the presentation on Friday, we will have some discussion of the mechanics of how these carry forward losses work.
Okay, that'll be good. Senator Bishop and then Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, these lease expenditures, capital lease expenditures, can you be a little more succinct? And we're talking about the most recent discoveries that this capital, am I tracking right? We're not, because I would think in the future we might have to put a slash, depending upon how the ANWR seismic, and if we get to go in there, right, and separate the two. This doesn't forecast any ANWR spending, does it?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, our revenue forecast does not include ANWR in any form.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just so I'm clear, on page 13, the tax value of carry forward annual losses, those aren't deductions being taken in that given year. Those are deductions that are accumulating for companies that can't deduct them off of their production taxes. Is that correct?
Sure. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that's correct. So what we've done here is we've taken any lease expenditures that are not able to be deducted in the year earned and get carried forward, and then we've multiplied those times the 35% statutory tax rate to arrive at the tax value.
Okay.
And moving on to slide 17, Mr. Chairman, this looks at forecasted North Slope operating expenditures. We have made only very minor adjustments to the operating expenditure forecast, so fairly stable operating expenditures at the existing units, and then once you get into the 2023-2024 timeframe, there's a little bit of a bump as some of the new developments come online, but not much change from the fall forecast here.
Good, continue. Don't worry, I'll stop you if there's a question. Unless you have a confession to make on that slide and you were waiting for us to ask something that we missed.
For the computer to catch up, sir.
Okay.
Sure, slide 18, which may come up on the...
Sometime.
Now?
I'll have a brief at ease.
Continue on, Mr. Chairman. Again, Dan Stickle for the record. Slide 18 shows our forecast of North Slope transportation costs. These are the costs of feeder pipelines, the Trans-Alaska pipeline, marine transportation costs, the cost of getting oil from the oil field to the market, and our forecast here, again, not much change from what we were expecting in the fall. Looking at a average transportation cost of $8.41 for fiscal year 19, and then increasing largely with inflation for the rest of the forecast.
So in your previous comment, you mentioned that the NPRA is not calculated in the revenue. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, we are including some production from NPRA. We are not including any production or exploration costs for ANWR.
Excuse me, ANWR. Yeah, okay, ANWR. So and then I assume that these numbers then don't take into account any cost of transporting ANWR volume out, which would push our TAPS tariff down per barrel. Is that not correct? And then
sure.
The numbers then could be get downward pressure put on them as we increase the flow, no matter where the oil comes from.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, production from ANWR, NPRA, any sort of new development would, in theory, decrease the cost per barrel of transporting oil on the Trans-Alaska pipeline. However, also added into this number would be any potential quality differentials for that new oil, as well as any feeder pipeline costs. So it would it would depend on the specific development, how the overall transportation cost number would change, but it would be a positive for the pipeline, for sure.
Senator Wilkowski.
What is the tariff to ship oil or condensate from Point Thompson into TAPS, just that feeder line?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I don't have that number off the top of my head. We can definitely
we get that.
Yes. Give back to the community, and that previously it was 28 cents, if I remember right. Substantially lower than that now, maybe, but we'll get an accurate number on that. That was some number that came back from memory back when we had the bottom of the oil prices. So we'll take a look at that. Senator Wilkowski.
Just on that, are the feeder lines from Point Thompson to Prudhoe to put it in TAPS and from NPRA into Prudhoe to put it into TAPS, are they lease expenditures or are they transportation costs?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, a feeder pipeline from the unit boundary is going to be a feeder transportation cost. It's going to show up here. A gathering line within the unit is going to be a lease expenditure. And there's some technical distinction there as well that we could provide more information if you'd like.
Yes, please.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
All right, Mr. Chairman, we have two slides left. This is for the cashable or the repurchase of credits. I won't speak too long on this. These are slides that you've seen before. These are the cashable credits. The program has been ended. That's why you see this liability to the state going to zero by 2024. FY19, we've already paid out the $100 million that was appropriated. FY20, about $180 million is included in the budget. And then we show this being paid off over the next couple of years under a statutory appropriation amount. Next slide, we can talk about the court case that's before us on the bond issue.
Okay, before we go there, there's a few questions on this slide. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the bottom in the small print there, it says per AS 4355028, statutory appropriation is 10% of production tax levied before credits. What credits are you referring to, and how much are those credits in FY 2020?
I think Dan might have the answer for you, Senator.
Again, Dan Stickle for the record. Senator Wilkowski through the chair. The statutory appropriation shown on slide 20 is calculated based on production tax due, which is primarily going to be at the 35% net rate before subtracting any credits, including primarily per taxable barrel credits.
What, Mr. Chair, how much is that amount scheduled to be in 2020?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the per taxable barrel credit forecast for 2020 is $1.26 billion.
Thank you.
I think if I could add, I think there's a few more. Is that the $8 plus the $5, or is that just the $8 credit per barrel credit?
That's both, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Senator Wilkowski?
Yes, thank you.
So for those watching at home, the point of the question is there's a debate whether the calculation used to pay these credits should be on the gross production tax value before the per barrel offset. So basically you'd be taking from a $5 billion revenue stream, you'd be subtracting out the 35% tax, which is basically 1.8 rounded numbers, and then you've got your per barrel slider off of 1.8 billion taken out, what, 1.26 or whatever it was referenced. There is a discussion or debate that some folks feel you shouldn't take those barrels first, or excuse me, you should take them out first before you calculate it. It's an ongoing discussion. Historically, we've not removed all the credits, which would substantially reduce the amount of credits we'd be paying per year and extending out that payment stream and increasing our net cash flow here at the table. And we're working, and we'll be hearing on future presentations on how to deal with the roughly, what have we got, $800 million in credits outstanding, some number in that range? Is that, Mr. Commissioner, can you help me with that number?
Yes, sir. I believe it's around $700 million,
sir. $700 million on repackaging that and trying to deal with that issue. And but these credits are terminated, and we're just paying off the liability, which is the point that Senator Wilkowski brings up, is the discussion of should we pay it on a net or gross amount, but it may become a mute issue here shortly. This session, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, I did, just on the prior slide, Mr. Chairman, 19. Are the refundable oil tax credits, has there been a history of auditing those, or have they ever been audited? Or do companies just come in and say, well, you owe me $200 million, and the department just writes a check?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I believe my tax director, Colleen Glover, is online if you'd like to have a conversation about that.
Ms. Glover, could you help us with that question, please?
This is Colleen Glover, for the record, Department of Revenue Tax Director. The credits are audited.
And what, can you help us with a little more explanation on that? Is that a guy just gets up one morning and looks at a sheet of paper and stamps it audit and hands a check? I think that was the question from Senator Wilkowski paraphrased, or how does the system work?
Chairman Stedman, those credits are basically 100% audited, just so we aren't giving money and then auditing after the fact and trying to get money back. So those are audited before we are refunding that money.
Yeah, Senator Wilkowski, and then we'll go to Senator Bishop.
Yeah. And over the years, how much money has been returned after audits, if any?
Could you give us, Ms. Grover, can you give us a estimate on the amount that was disputed after you sent the check, or the state sent the check, and how much adjustments were back, if any, on either issue?
Chairman Stedman, I don't have that off the tip of my tongue. I can get that information back to you.
Okay, you can get that back to the commissioner, and we'll have that up Friday when we have the further discussion. That'll be good timing. Senator Bishop.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I thought, are you able to just give us two examples that would be a qualified credit expenditure and two examples that wouldn't, just to help the public at home know what we're paying for?
Ms. River, can you help with that, or do you want the commissioner to answer that?
No, Senator Bishop, through the chair, there's qualified capital expenditures, there's qualified lease expenditures, there's different type of expenditures depending on whether it's a exploration work or whether it's from production. So there's a bunch of different types of credits that in the past qualified for the cash repurchase.
And just to add one point to that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bishop, we follow the federal IRS code as far as what is a capital expenditure.
Thank you. I just wanted the people at home to just as an idea. Thank you.
And just for those that aren't as familiar with this is process, to avoid lengthy legal action and never-ending debates on what is a capital expenditure and what's an operating expenditure, we decided when we went into a net system back in 06 or whenever it was that we would be using the IRS rules to govern that direction, because they've been established for decades and decades with court cases. And then we have some exclusions to protect the state from deductibility of expenditures that may not be applicable to the state. Oil basin, for instance, it could be out-of-state expenditures or certain in-state expenditures that aren't included. But the industry still gets to deduct those expenditures on their corporate income tax. So this is not a corporate income tax issue, it's a severance tax issue. So the basic decision is IRS guidelines for those watching at home, and there's a lot of nuances involved, but that's the basic gist of it. But before we move on, I'm just kind of curious. When I took a look at the earnings or revenue source book back here in fall 18 and took a look at the update here, and when we started looking at the credits, for instance, the credits that are showing for last in the fall for 2020, the upcoming year, was $1,963 million or $1.9 billion. When I take a look at the number published here a couple days ago, it was $1.5 billion. So there's $400 million that disappeared, and then there was in 2021 there was $1.2 billion rounded off, and the new number is $1.7 billion for 21. These are statewide total production tax credits. So can you help me with why within just a couple months there's these $500 million swings, and how we, the mere mortals from the public, can keep track of this stuff?
Sure, Dan Stickle for the record. Mr. Chairman, so that change between fiscal year 2020 and 2021 has to do primarily with a convention of how we show outstanding repurchasable credits in the revenue sources book. So in the fall revenue sources book, we showed that the entire balance of outstanding credits would be paid off in fiscal year 2020. That assumption was informed in part by the bonding package that was out there. The subsequent delays due to litigation and issuance of those bonds, for purposes of the revenue forecast, we're now showing the statutory appropriation in fiscal year 2020 and then the entire outstanding balance of repurchasable credits in fiscal year 2021. So when you look in the revenue sources book, you saw a large number of credits in fiscal 2020 in the fall book, and now a larger number of credits in fiscal 2021 in the spring book.
Okay. So just a word of caution, when you compare books to books, things are in motion. The other question is, if we repackage these bonds, there's a court case going through right now that, depending on how it comes out, we may issue bonds and pay these off if it becomes favorable. If we don't do that, there is some discussion that maybe we repackage these bonds and almost gift them, it's kind of a loose term, to another entity within the state, and they pay them off. So how are we going to track that at the finance table if we have mechanisms like that to ensure that the folks sitting here, senators sitting here, and the other elected officials in the building clearly can track the amount of expenditures, if they're a credit or a direct expenditure or a revenue, whatever it happens to be? How do we handle that within this source book so we can see what's going on?
Mr. Chairman, that is a work in progress. We're looking at some other options. We do have the third bullet on here, if I could just close that out on the court case itself. The Superior Court granted the state's motion to dismiss. The plaintiff did appeal the case on February 21st. Therefore, we're anticipating a delay. It's going to the Supreme Court, so we're still hoping to pay these off, as Mr. Stickle mentioned, through the existing HB 331 language that put the corporation in place. I think what you're referring to are other options. Are there other state entities that could bond for this? We're exploring those options. I think we can't speak to anything yet because nothing has been solidified. But I think you would certainly see it move from one balance sheet to another. If it's going to another state entity, it would become their responsibility. And it'd be very clear for the Finance Committee. We'd probably have a couple hearings on that alone just to make sure everybody agreed with the process.
Right. The concern I have is not that we agree or disagree, but whatever action we take here at the committee, that action is recognized within the documents, financial documents presented to the committee, not For instance, if we want to take a look at royalties, we see the action within the royalty arena. If we want to look at severance tax, we see the action and the consequences of those actions in the severance tax, good or bad, to the net cash flow. And we're going to have that cash flow question, our discussion here Friday. But when and if we have another proposal to deal with these credits, one of the questions it will be is how are we going to recognize those easily here at the table and not pretend like they all of a sudden disappeared and they're on someone else's other entity within the state's balance sheet and they're not sitting here in the middle of the table demanding part of the feeding frenzy on the net cash, which we split up every year trying to make our payroll and do our capital budget or whatever else we're doing here at the table. Mm-hmm. So there is a concern that we don't make that ugly tar pit just through creative accounting just vanish. We can move it, but we want to make sure it's always recognized here that we have substantial payments and impacts from the decision here at this table going forward. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you explain to the general public who the plaintiffs are and explain why in bullet point number two they are, what are they basing their arguments on?
Yes, sir. Senator Hoffman, through the chair. It is a, it's a single plaintiff. He's, and I'm not an attorney, so I'm not gonna venture too far down this road, but he is, it is based on subject to appropriation claims. One legislature binding future legislators. So that's, under this scenario, the balance of the debt that we owe would be bonded for, and then it would be paid off through debt service over X number of years, fairly short timeline. And I believe the plaintiff is claiming it's they're not legal because of the subject to appropriations issue.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other question, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I just had a, one on the reason you dumped the remaining credit onto 21. I mean, I know you say for forecast purposes only, but that's probably unrealistic. Just wondering why you didn't stagger it through a different schedule than repayment in 21.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, we could have showed it several different ways, I believe, but we're anticipating a favorable outcome at the Supreme Court level, hoping for, and that would allow us to clear this debt from our books through the bonding process. So that's just the process that we chose to show.
So if you can remind the committee members how you dealt with that in the FY20 revenue forecast here, the actual cash at the table. How did you look at that going forward for FY20, the bonds in your forecast? The negative cash flow it's going to put in the table if we pay it or not pay it.
Mr. Chairman, if I understand your question, it's a debt service that would be shown as how these would be paid out.
No, no, how did you, what's in the documents, what's in the numbers that you presented us for 19 and 20? What's the structure of those debts?
Mr. Chairman, in the spring forecast, we show the $100 million that was appropriated for 19, and for 20, we show the $184 that was the statutory calculation.
So it's the statutory calculation,
yes,
for FY20.
And that's all we're showing for that fiscal year.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So I'm just looking at page 13 of the, this new book, and it shows that I can see the credits purchased by the state to 19, I'm on page 13, starts in fiscal year 19 and goes forward to fiscal 28. I see the per barrel credit. I see a lot of these other credits, and I see the very bottom total statewide production tax credits of $1.4 billion for 2020. Is from your slide number 20, it shows for 2020 about $600 million in outstanding for repurchase. Is that figure also on page 13 somewhere? I just don't see it.
Sure. Senator Von Imhoff through the chair. This is Dan Stickle. So slide 20 and slide 21 are presenting a slightly different view of the tax credits. Mm-hmm. Slide 20 shows what the ending balance and repurchase amount would be if the legislature were to make the statutory appropriation for every year under the forecast. And in that scenario, we'd pay a little over $100 million every year, and then the final amount of the repurchasable credits would be retired in 2024. In the spring revenue forecast on 2013, we use a little bit different convention. We assume that the statutory appropriation is made for fiscal 19 and fiscal 20, and then the entire amount of outstanding credits are repurchased in fiscal 2021 instead of being spread over the four-year time horizon.
On page 13.
We got Senator Majikian and Senator Hoffman.
So that goes back to my question. If I mean the purpose of a bond is to spread that payment over time, but it seems to be showing the total repayment in one lump. Isn't that a strange way to show bond repayment over time?
So, Senator Majikian, through the chair, if the bonding is made for the outstanding balance of credits from a revenue standpoint, that retires the outstanding credit balance. And then the payments on that bond become a budget. They're part of the budget side of the equation. So that would show up in the budget documents and the 10-year plan. But at that point, from a revenue forecast standpoint, it would not be part of our forecast anymore.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we passed House Bill 331, we were authorizing the issuance of up to $1 billion in bond sales. The question that I have is that number going to be the amount that we owed in 2018, and will we get, for instance, in 2020, the $180 million that we're appropriating, so we would get those funds back and the bonds would be sold accordingly? Or are you assuming to sell the bonds at the lower amount after 2020 of $600
million? Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, I don't know the answer to that yet. I understand what you're saying. If we bond for the full amount come next spring, would we have already spent down the appropriation if you choose to appropriate $184 million? I believe that's what you're asking.
My question is, yes, are we going to be reimbursed for those dollars and from the bond sale, or are you going to sell a lower amount in the bond sale? It would seem that it would have been advantageous, given our cash situation, that we would follow the intent of that particular piece of legislation and reimburse us of that amount.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, I think we'd certainly entertain a discussion on that topic. I understand what you're saying, that we would want to take advantage of the opportunity that we have if we are able to bond for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Either reimburse us or put out the bond in it at a lower amount to decrease our cash strain going forward, but not to fatten the kitty to add more debt and have a couple hundred million slopping around. That's the point of the question, I think. So we'll have that discussion coming up. Senator Hoffman has a good point.
And to be clear, Senator, we will only bond for the balance that's due. We won't bond for an additional amount.
Okay. You have other questions on this slide before we speedily along to the next one? Go ahead and continue.
That's the end of this presentation, sir. We do have a three or four slide presentation on the oil and gas production tax audit update.
Okay, we will have them up. Same crew, different chairs, maybe?
My tax director, I believe, in Anchorage will speak to this. Okay.
Is that Ms. Glover? Is that who you want to do the presentation?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'll call her up here when you're ready. Ms. Glover, the commissioner has put you in the hot seat to take us through a few slides.
Okay.
Can you do that for us, please?
Yep. For the record, again, Colleen Glover, Department of Revenue Tax Director, and I'll just kind of give you an update from the last update in January and where we are with the oil and gas production tax audit.
Maybe if you could stop there, just stop there before you dive into just an update. Can you give us a kind of a synopsis of a little history so the folks at home can follow the conversation, or it might be relatively meaningless to most of the public, and that's who these committee meetings are for?
Certainly. So where we're at right now with the oil and gas production tax audits, we are working the 2013 tax year. There in the past, there was a substantial backlog, and it took sometimes up until the six-year statutory maximum to get those audits completed. We're working to change that, to not be pushing that 6 years and get things back on track or on track to have a kind of a three-year audit completion cycle. We, for the past year or so, the audit team has been focused on working the 2012 and 2013 tax years kind of simultaneous. A lot of, you know, the underlying tax was similar. They worked them together, but did finalize the 2012 already and worked those, and now we're in the process of finalizing the 2013 audit.
If you can stop there for a minute. If you could stop there for a minute, I think, let me help you with the earlier question. Back in roughly 06, we went from a gross tax to a net tax. And having a net tax, you have deductions, obviously. But as you go forward, the tax returns are filed. The vast majority of expenditures are not questioned. There is some differences of agreement or opinion on what some items should or should not have been deducted, so that we go back and review every year of our net tax. We're talking about our severance tax, and ensure that the proper deductions are taken and the proper tax to the state and so on and so forth is collected or returned if there's an overpayment. And we have had multiple tax changes over that decade and a half, leading to difficulty in keeping up with regulations and audits. And the complexity of our tax structure is, it's one of the most complex in the world. And we have an audit department that continually works through these audits. I think there's a 6 year, if I recall, 6 years limitation statute on it. So we are always concerned that we don't go over the 6 years statute of limitation. In fact, there's an interest in having these audits done in 2-3 years out. Sooner the better for both parties, the industry and the state, because there's a substantial amount of interest owed to whoever's on the owing side of the equation. So the concern at the table is, what is the status of our audits, and where and how close are we to coming across the six-year statute of limitation, and what is the chances of catching up and knocking out those audits who are only, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 years behind? It's a discussion that is taking place within the subcommittee process, and it comes to the table almost every year. So we asked the commissioner if he could give us, the committee and the public, kind of an update on the status of the backlog in audits and the flow, because we've had a stable tax structure for several years, and that should hopefully enable some of the catch-up in the time frame. So in a kind of a brief synopsis, that's what we're dealing with at the table. It's not an audit where we just pick up a random selection of a given individual. It's basically a review of our net profits tax on an ongoing basis. So, Ms. Glover, if you could I guess, and pick up your presentation. I think you want to talk about 2012. The audits are complete, so that's a good sign, and take it from there, if you would.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was a good summary of the past and also other kind of things leading to this backlog, or, you know, progressivity made things complicated up through 2012, and then also just, you know, we didn't have a good system or computer system, and now we have what we call TRIMS, the Tax Revenue Management System, which allows the taxpayers to file online. It gives us data that we have access to. So we didn't have that prior to 2014. So it was complex taxes changing, and we didn't have the best tools to work from. So good news is, you know, 2012 kind of behind us. We're wrapping up 2013. They're in the final stages of review, and so we're hoping to get those done here in the next month. And then the good news after 2013 is then that gets us into the SB 21 years, and then for the next, you know, 6-7 years, it's pretty much the same, fairly stable. There was some minor tweaks with HB 247 and HB 111, but for the most part, the fundamental tax regime is the same, and so we have really good stability going forward. We have good tools going forward, and we're really optimistic and planning to get the backlog behind us. And moving on to slide 3, once we get the 2013 audits completed, you know, it gives us some time to kind of stop and plan. And we actually have already been working planning sessions with the leads, coming up with good tools to go forward, having kind of structured audit plans and engagement plans with the taxpayers, and really looking just to kind of improve two-way communication with the taxpayers, and to really focus in on issues and risks for the audits instead of doing 100% audit as we have done in the past, which led to the amount of time it took. Also moving into 2014, we get into low oil price years, so minimum taxpayer years. So there's probably not worth the time to do in-depth audit on lease expenditures if that's really not really a factor in the ultimate tax that's owed. So we're really trying to be thoughtful and plan well so we can execute our improvement plan.
Here, I got a question for the commissioner. Can you, is this just Izzy work, or are we talking about real dollars here?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't call it busy work. I would call it more putting in place a plan. Real dollars as far as cost?
No. I'm trying to get you to tell the public how much money we're talking about potentially in dispute here over the years. Are we talking?
Mr. Chairman, there's hundreds of millions, upwards of billions of dollars that change hands depending on the price of oil and the amount of production. So it is significant amounts of dollars that we are auditing and that are being paid by the taxpayers each year.
And those significant dollars, they're in the hundreds of millions a lot of times, come into the Treasury. And how do they come into the Treasury? And explain to the public with this why we're interested in this.
Mr. Chairman, we could talk much more in depth on Friday, but monthly tax payments are made. Estimates are made. A true-up is made by the taxpayer at the end of the year. They file their tax return in the spring of the following year, and then that's when the audit takes place. So while that is being done on a regular basis, the payments, the true-up at the end of the year, the tax return is filed in March, then the waiting process takes place because of the backlog.
And we could be looking at hundreds of millions of dollars in potential adjustments in audits. Some years it's well over $100 million that comes into the Treasury. And then where does it go in the Treasury? Go to the CBR, go to the general fund, goes to the, you know, governor's mansion, slush account. Got to tell the public what we're doing.
Tax payments, Mr. Chairman, are deposited to the general fund.
Okay, thank you. Senator Machicki.
Mr. Chairman, we throw the term taxpayers out kind of liberally around here, and there are folks that think they're taxpayers, and then there are people in this context that are taxpayers. Can the commissioner tell us which taxpayers he's talking about in this hundreds of millions of dollars context?
You could help Senator Machicki with that. Who's the major operators that we've been talking about most of the day, and where are they located?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Machicki, the largest taxpayers historically have been Conoco, BP, and Exxon. We now have some other taxpayers in the state, such as Hillcorp, and some other smaller companies as well.
It's a major.
But there's not many of them.
I think we have Senator Hoffman and Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Tangeman, when you're looking at these backlogs, it would seem as though the legislature hasn't been giving enough attention or funding to the audit division. So can you give us historically what has the legislature done to try to address this backlog in additional staffing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, the biggest assistance that the legislature put in place was the revenue management system itself. We were conducting taxes through spreadsheet. We were significantly behind, and this was 2011, 2012, when we finally got the capital appropriation, to put a revenue management system in place. I think historically, I don't have the actual PCN counts over the last, 10 to 15 years, but I do believe that the legislature has recognized the importance of the audit division and the importance of this revenue stream to the state. So I think it's been a good working relationship between the executive branch asking for the appropriate resources and then the legislature appropriating the funds for those resources so that the department and the division can do their job. So I think it's been a very good back and forth, making sure that the staffing is there to do this job.
And if I recall, it was a $35 million appropriation. Is that not correct?
Yes, sir.
So we've spent significant sums of money to get the department off of spreadsheets to deal with these audits, and the audits are dealing with hundreds of millions, not into the billions of dollars. So this is a significant issue. Before we go on with the presentation, I see Senator Wilson's been wanting to ask a question. Apparently I didn't see his hand. He's got to wave it a little more, send up a smoke signal or something. But go ahead, Senator Wilson, and then we'll go to Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, can you or Director Glover, in looking at improving our timeliness of these filing of the audits and the taxes, and with the difficulties with different tax regimes, the regulation, the audits of the oil and gas tax credits, can you talk about the effectiveness or the efforts of working with the industry to clarify some of these regulations? Is that something that could help expedite or just improve the timeliness?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilson, we have been working with the taxpayers, with the private sector. Governor Dunleavy has made that one of his higher priorities, is to take a look back at the regulations, see what's, I believe he calls it deregulation, but really, from my perspective in my department and division, it's the cleaning up of regulations. As we went from ELF, which was gross, to PPT, to ACES, to SB 21, big changes to the statutes, but also big additions to regulations as well. And now that we've been under SB 21 for 5 years, but we're just starting to audit it, it does give us an opportunity to go back and clean up some of those regulations, delete those that are no longer needed. So it is a good opportunity. That's part of the stop, evaluate, and plan that Ms. Glover spoke to as well.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we don't too often talk about, we do things in this building and then we don't often see the results. And this is, I think, a result of a good investment that was made by the legislature, by you, Mr. Chairman, and the senator from Bethel also, to fund that auditing management system, because it's probably saved us or made us hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars from that small investment. But my question is, the 2013 audits, I don't know how does this roll along. Are we at risk of not being able to audit January, February, March of 2013? Are we at risk of losing that time frame because we're now beyond 6 years from that time frame?
I think we have more of the presentation to go. We got slide 4, and that might tie in better to the next slide. And the Ms. Glover, she could help us with her last slide and then address Senator Wilikowski's question as how what's on the border of falling outside of the 6 year extension.
Hey, Senator Chairman Stedman, Colleen Glover for the record again. The timing, the 2013, the 6 years is from the date that the tax return was filed, and the oil and gas tax returns are due at the end of March the following year. So the 2013 tax year returns were due March 31st, 2014. So the 6 year limitation on audit isn't until March 2020. So we're actually going to be a year ahead now. So this will be kind of the first year where we're catching up and kind of not being on the 6 year timeline and then working towards a 3 year turnaround time. So we're not at risk on the 2013 to missing a statutory cutoff date on that. And so going into future audits, you know, we just kind of have a plan to work this backlog down. The 2014 audits, we're going to work just 1 year for that year, only because it is a new tax year. It's the first year we really have our TRIM system and good data. So for us, 2014 is really a critical year for us to really kind of have a comprehensive view going forward and how we can use this data for future audits. So 2014 will be done by itself. 2015 to 2017 audits, we feel we can do them together. Those were low oil price years, mostly minimum tax years. If you look at some of the tax tables that were provided to the committee in January, you can see that the collections for tax were a lot lower from 15 to 17. So we plan to do those 3 years together, and then following up with 18 and 19 together, that would get us on a 3 year cycle. We're confident, you know, we can do that. We feel like we have the right resources, we have adequate staffing levels, we have our TRIM system that we learn more and more about every year. We get more efficient. We're getting taxpayer feedback not only on our process, but also on the tool. So our TRIM system is a two-way tool. It's used by the taxpayer to file stuff. It's used by the tax department to get information for reporting, and also you can do analysis and make changes to returns. So it's a very robust tool that helps us quite a bit in what we do. And just one other thing for clarification earlier, so when the taxpayer files their monthly returns, they're paying each month, they're estimating that a tax return goes to the general fund. If there's a assessment, once our audit team goes through and issues a formal tax assessment for additional tax owed, that assessment amount then would go to the CBRF when and if we collect it. And that was all I had, unless you guys have other questions.
Okay, and then those for watching at home, the reference to the years 2015 and 17, the way the tax structure for severance works on low prices, we actually calculated on a gross value, not a net value. So we don't have the interest or the there's not a reason to itemize all the deductions because it's on a gross calculation. So it's kind of like two separate tax regimes embedded into one. So that will speed up the audits, but it significantly impacted the Treasury to the negative side when we had the low prices. So we have other questions. There's a question on the settlements if they go to the, you know, they go to the general fund, but there is some concern from some of the members that isn't really where they should be going. Historically, there's an interest, and they've been going to the CBR. I think there's a differences of opinion that was kind of referenced earlier by a question by Senator Hoffman, so we'll have to work on that at the table here over the next few months and sort that out. But as referenced by Senator Hoffman, if they go to the general fund, we can move them to the CBR if we so choose. The question is, where do they automatically go? And we have differences of opinion with the other branch of government, so we'll sort that out. It's one of these issues that we need to work on when the time is correct. Senator Michiki.
Mr. Chairman, if you're okay with it, I have one quick question from the last presentation. We don't have to bring it up. It was just, if you don't mind, and then just one quick statement on Friday. You can't put enough time into explaining the difference between qualified capital and operating credits versus per barrel. The public lumps them together. It's the way it's written about it. I hope that's something we're going to cover. That's a question for you first.
Yes, that'll probably come up Friday when we lay out. Okay. What I've asked the department to do Friday is a net cash flow analysis. Obviously, here at the table, it's the net cash flow that we have to appropriate, not some number above that, because it doesn't exist at the table for us to move around, pay our bills and make our payroll and pay dividends or whatever we're going to do with it. And I've asked them to lay out 2017 and 18 because they're historical numbers, 17 being in the minimum tax year, 19 the year we're in now, what they expect, because a lot of the data is already known, some of it's not because it's, you know, we're halfway through the year, and then a projection for 20 and 21. So that will give us kind of a view of the net cash coming in 20 and 21. 20 being the budget that's in the middle of the table, and 21 will be here next winter.
And then I had that question for either Mr. Steckel or the commissioner. You don't need to, obviously, don't bring it up, but when you showed the slide about production risk, your line of the forecast is still the mean, and you talked about some upside risk. But other than short-term production blips, it doesn't seem like the downside risk is the same as it was. I mean, you default back to the 6% decline, which is less likely than it was. Can you explain why you averaged the risk as opposed to leaning a little bit higher with news we've heard and the reduction in the risk that we return to the 6% decline?
Through the chairman, Senator Michiki, I think a detailed analysis of that should come from DNR, but I think the risk factor gets greater the further out in time we're expecting the production to come on. So very little risk for something that's happening now, obviously, in the coming months, but if we're hearing in one of the publications or one of the companies that says, you know, a field is coming on in 6 years, well, we apply quite a bit of risk to that just because a lot of capital has to be invested in order to bring that on. We don't know what the price of oil is going to do. If prices crash, that investment may not take place. So the risk just gets greater and greater the further out in time you look at.
So we can get some of that data back from Department of Natural Resources, too, on the projections of volume. We have any other questions for the presenters today while we have the commissioner in the hot seat? Seeing none, that'll conclude the meeting today. Tomorrow, 9 a.m., we're going to pick up the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, better known as ADA, an acronym, on their projects, their investments, and their cash flow, and that'll we get, for those watching at home, ADA pays the state a dividend back to the general fund that we then appropriate here at the table. So that should be a very interesting presentation. Look forward to seeing everybody here again tomorrow, 9 a.m. We're adjourned.